Welcome to Segue to Success, an internet-based radio program dedicated to helping privately owned businesses survive and thrive in today's business climate.
I'm Brent Hamachek.
And I'm Tom Kuchin.
And I guess, you know, I'm trying to think what we would like to talk about today. It seems to me there's something in the news. There's a big story. There was an election last night.
Really?
And, yeah.
There were a few elections last night.
I think, you know, and one of the things that we do for our clients is we do forecasting. And forecasting, of course, is a way of, you know, doing a prediction of what's going to happen in your business. And based upon our forecasting capabilities for last night's election, I suspect we'll be fired by everybody by the end of the day today.
Well, luckily we don't forecast politics. We do forecast businesses.
Right. We don't. But a lot of people that do didn't do much better, and that's kind of interesting, and we'll get to that. So I watched the election last night on Fox. Tom, you watched it on
Fox and Twitter.
Fox and Twitter. So
following along on social media.
So just some general thoughts and reflections on what you saw. What did you think last night? What was the first moment you were surprised by anything or had a feeling that maybe the night wasn't going to go the way we thought it was going to go?
Well, I'll speak for myself here. I thought that the election was going to turn out the other way. I thought Romney was going to win. I thought he was going to win, say, fairly handedly. And where it started hitting me was when North Carolina, Virginia, Florida. Florida, I expected to take a while, but especially North Carolina and Virginia were taking so much longer than I expected to come to a decision. That's when it started to become clear to me.
I think it was, for me, it was North Carolina. You know, I was watching the results and thinking, why haven't they been able to call that state yet? It really doesn't make any sense.
Right. Especially North Carolina.
Yeah. That was the one. And so, you know, if anybody read our blog during the week, and if you didn't, gosh, you really should, because we put an awful lot of work into that.
If you're curious, you can find an easy link to the blog on our website at www.segwaysolutions.com.
Wow, what a gratuitous plug. That was terrific. Well done, partner. You can tell if you read our blog, even though we didn't make an official endorsement, that you know, we think it's morning in America today, and we're spelling that not M-O-R-N.
How are you spelling it?
I think it's M-O-U-R-N.
Oh, okay, got it.
So we're morning in America today. I think
we are wearing black, by the way.
We are both wearing black. Well, once we get to some sort of a webcast, video cast for you guys, you'll be able to see our wardrobes. But you know, I'm disappointed. I think that you know, at the presidential level, not only did I think that Romney was going to win, but I really thought that he needed to win. And I thought, I had said last week when I was a guest on a Link Local Network panel program that aired live and where there's going to be a YouTube presentation of it soon, you know, I made a statement that I thought this was the most important election since 1860. And I meant that. It wasn't hyperbole. I wasn't trying to be dramatic. I really think it was the most important election, certainly in our lifetime. And I think we made a choice last night as a nation about a particular path that certainly, A, we're on, and B, we are not going to just be able to hop off 4 years from now if we don't like it. Mm-hmm. I don't know what your thought is.
Right. I would tend to agree with that. I think, you know, with our predictions, there's been a lot of thinking going on today about how certainly I got so surprised by the results. And when you look back at the polls were basically predicting this, so the polls were fairly accurate.
Mm-hmm.
However, I've kind of come to at least my initial conclusion as of this minute is that we get our data input on this election from our friends, family, obviously, but also all our business contacts, and that is small businesses. Mm-hmm. And small businesses, I think, we're looking at this election a certain way. However, there's a whole chunk of the population that is not seeing this election through the same prism that we are and our network is.
Yeah, I mean, our brains play tricks on us. And we take whatever information is that we've got, and then our brain seems to construct a story around it. And certainly we got tricked a little bit by the story. You know, in my way of thinking, I had heard on another radio show the other day, a show not anywhere near as good as ours, of course, but I heard somebody say that if you're going to believe that Obama's going to win the election, you've got to believe that, A, more people will or fewer people will turn out for Romney as Republicans than turned out for McCain. You have to believe that.
Right.
You have to believe that more independents will vote for Obama than Romney, and Romney won't do as well as McCain with independents. And you have to believe that all the people that turned out for Obama 4 years ago would turn out again, and that's a lot to believe.
Right.
Well, it sounded like it was a lot to believe, but now that the election's over, maybe one of the things we just didn't consider is this is what the American people want. We've been telling ourselves for 4 years, and a lot of people who view politics and economics the way we do, we've been telling ourselves, well, gosh, everybody made a mistake 4 years ago. You know, he ran as a moderate. He indicated that he was going to bring people together, that it wasn't going to be a divisive style of governing, and so on. And then we've had 4 years of experience. And we thought, okay, well, all those people that were perhaps brought into that 4 years ago, now they'll see differently. But perhaps they saw it then, and perhaps they see it now, and perhaps they like what they see.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I had heard that Obama said before he even ran the first time was that one of his gifts is that he can say things where everybody heard what they wanted to hear. I think 4 years ago, you and I heard something we didn't want it or we didn't like, so we voted against him. We heard the same thing this time. But the people that were hearing what they wanted to hear from him 4 years ago were still hearing the same thing they wanted to hear this time around. And like you said, they liked what they hear. There's another take on this, I think, which a couple of friends have mentioned to me when we're trying to figure out what happened. And their take is that the economy is so bad for so many people, because we have something like 23 million unemployed or underemployed in this country, that they are so afraid that they can't do it on their own, that in order to get back to be employed, they do need a little help from the government, from the federal government. And that the Republicans have been presented to them by the Democrats as standing in their way, that the Republicans are actually going to make it more difficult for them as individuals to get to where they want to be economically.
And that's a fairly interesting construct on their part. Just like maybe we built up our story around why polls were wrong and we were right, you know, building that sort of an idea about what Republicans would or wouldn't do to impede their entry or their success in the job market. And if you really step back from that, and if you had the time to tear that down and take a look at it, there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm in the process, as you know, of working on an article that I hope to have published eventually about the divide in this country between what we call right and left. And without going into detail on that right now, in the process of trying to get this article written, I've been interviewing people for the last 4 or 5 months,
mm-hmm.
regular people, people like you and I, people like the folks, well, not that
we're
any,
regular
not
about
not that well, wait, we're regular, but there's nothing regular about our listeners. So you folks are listening. You're not regular. We're mundane, but you're remarkable. We love all of you.
Exceptional.
Right. What I really mean by regular is people who are not involved in the political process, citizens who have jobs, who maybe own companies. So I'm not talking about mm-hmm. middle income, lower income, higher income. I'm talking about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And going through sort of a battery of questions about issues and understanding of political terms and those sorts of things. And it is fascinating because what I've done isn't scientific, but it's enlightening. Most people that I talk to during this process were planning to vote for Obama. And most people, when I ran them through a litany of 18 different issues, what we could call litmus test issues in politics, they'd score anywhere from 11 to 15 the way that you and I would score as guys voting for Romney.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they were going to vote for Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And what was very interesting about that is the single most determinative issue, men and women, is abortion. And there were people that agree on every single issue that we might agree on,
mm-hmm.
from whether it might be capital punishment, whether it might be balanced budgets, you name it, on and on. But on that particular issue, they're pro-choice, and that's what their vote was about. And so on some level, it makes sense out of all that. We might have had, in part, a decision last night based on a 1973 Supreme Court ruling. And that's pretty fascinating.
Which is, and as a husband and a father of two young women, all of whom vote conservatively. I hope I'm not dragging anybody out of the closet there. They would be extremely surprised by that because they don't feel threatened. They don't feel, as women, they're threatened by the Republican Party or that their lives would change as it comes to their, say, individual rights or individual ability to run their lives the way they want to. None of that would change if they voted Republican. So what do these people think, these women that you're interviewing that would be voting for Obama on that issue, what do they think the alternative is? If they vote Republican, what's going to happen?
Well, this is not anything that is thoroughly reasoned or specifically tied to a string of events that would take place. It's a knee jerk. It's a tap on the kneecap. Pro-choice, not pro-choice, like it, don't like it. And so when the Republican Party is considered to be, in general, against abortion rights, there's a reflex to say, I don't want that person in office representing me.
Hmm.
When you get to the what is it you think they will do, when you ask that follow-up question, the answer is, in general, I don't have any idea. So it's not about something specific. It is simply enough
which
that
is,
they hold that view.
Which is a very interesting segue because
we love segues. That's bad when you prompt me on my own line, and I miss
the. Because I rarely get to say it. You're the one always saying it. To the Senate results in the
right.
Senate races. I mean, off the top of my head, there are two: Indiana and Missouri, where the Republican running for Senate should have won, but they stuck their foot in their mouth by saying something just completely stupid as it relates to abortion.
Right, and that did it. You know, in both those states, you have Romney winning the state, but the Senate candidate losing, and in particular in Missouri. Where everybody thought, you know, Claire McCaskill was ripe to be beaten,
right.
She winds up winning, and she winds up winning without coattails. I mean, not from coattails because
right.
Obama didn't carry that state.
Right.
So imagine that in a state where people voted for Romney, they deliberately took the time to make sure that they voted against the Republican Senate candidate who had taken that unusual stance or made that. And it was a ridiculous statement. It's impossible to defend it.
Right.
They took the time to make that vote. And,
right.
you know that's, again, a segue to the Senate race in general and the House race and what we've seen happen in that regard. You know, we live in Illinois, and
yes,
I was struck.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. For those of you who don't know, we confess we're Illinois people. We saw two first-term congressmen knocked out right here where we live,
right.
Bob Dole and Joe Walsh, literally swept out in part by, for Walsh, it was some of his remarks
right.
that he made.
Right.
But Obama even appeared to have some coattails. Democrats pick up three seats in the Senate.
Right.
Republicans only pick up one.
Right.
You know, the Republicans hold in the House, but nonetheless, there were some folks that were defeated who were Republicans. So this is very interesting.
Well, and we had a congressman who won who never campaigned a day because he disappeared.
Right.
Jesse Jackson Jr., and one who's been federally indicted.
Right.
Who won also. And these are and winning by massive margins.
Right. So, you know, some people would call this a close election. You know, in my mind, the way I look at it, I actually don't think it's a close election. And I think it's something much bigger than that. I think what we're seeing really is not the beginnings, a little bit further along. We're seeing a confirmation of the beginnings of what I believe to be a sort of a permanent trend in American political life, which means in American economic life. And that is this notion that we are going to look towards more central planning, more central control, more direction of the activities of the market, and that means direction of our everyday lives. And that's going to impact each and every one of us.
Centrally out of Washington, not at a state level.
That's right. That's right. The notion of state rights makes me feel like I'm some sort of an anachronism, even to know, mention that I know the term. Well, this will bring us to a situation where that we have coming up now where we've got sequestration. We've got the tax cuts that are expiring.
Taxmageddon.
Yeah, Taxmageddon. And the impact that's going to have on everybody in this country. What are your thoughts on what's going to play out here?
Well, for those who may want a little bit of background on that, there are basically two things happening come January. One is commonly known as Taxmageddon. And Taxmageddon is essentially a handful of things. One is it is an unprecedented tax hike. It's a combination of the expiration of tax rates that were put into place under President Bush, number 43. It's also expiring payroll tax reductions, I believe, from Obama's first term.
Right.
And it is also the implementation of some of Obamacare's Obamacare new taxes that they're supporting. That I think it's a 3.8% surcharge on incomes over $250,000. So I'm looking at something here from the Heritage Foundation, and the impact of this is pretty substantial. We're talking about a good half a trillion dollars more coming out of the private economy going into government hands in 2013. Another $500 billion to be used by the government and not used by the private sector. In addition, that's Taxmageddon. And the other thing we're talking about is sequestration. Sequestration was a budget deal. If we remember going into last year, the Congress could not agree on a new budget. On cost cutting and so on, and they put together a deal whereby if they couldn't, if they didn't come up with a deal, there would be automatic budget cuts, which supposedly no one was going to be able to support. So it put the pressure on them to come up with a deal. Well, no deal's been made, and in that there's another $500 billion or so coming out of in budget cuts spread between the defense. Defense Department, and also some across-the-board cuts in other discretionary spending.
So how much, you know, let's just take a deep breath and get prepared for a little bit of a rant. Because one of the things that ought to infuriate everybody who's listening to us right now on this show, by the way, did we mention we love our listeners? Thanks for tuning in. Regardless of your politics, this notion that people that we elected and sent to Washington to make decisions on our behalf, because most of us, at least in theory, have a job, so we don't get to go do it ourselves, and that's not the way our government's set up anyway. We elect these people and we send them to Washington to make decisions that impact every element of our lives. And when they sit down together and say, we have a mess, we have had an orgy of spending for decades. We have overpromised, overcommitted, in every single area of government that we possibly can. Now we have to pay the bill. We have to figure out a way to do it. They cannot sit down and come up with a way to agree to do it. Mm-hmm. They, in our side, you know, we're not in favor of tax increases. We think that's the wrong way to do it because we simply don't think it would work. But regardless of our opinion or your opinion, if you're listening to us, what is offensive beyond belief is that these people deliberately voted on something that would kick the problem past an election so that they could get elected again. So they could do what? Do the same thing all over again. Mm-hmm. Would it surprise you if the solution to the sequestration problem is a new piece of legislation that advances the date for the sequestration?
Right. No, not at all. Because this is just, the sequestration is incredibly complex, and you see it now. Nobody wants to do it, but coming up with a compromise is going. It takes months and months and months of negotiation. They don't have months. I can't remember the exact date, but they're not in session until what? At least another week or two. And then they're bumping into Thanksgiving, and then they're bumping into the end-of-year holidays. There isn't time to put a real deal that's workable together.
Right. And so I think the most likely outcome to this, you know, we know it's a law. We know they passed the law. We know they have to make the decision on what they're going to do or the sequestration takes place. But any law they pass, they can amend, change, or repeal. And I suspect what we're going to see is some form of another delay. Maybe we'll delay it until the end of 2013. And at the end of 2013, they can argue about it into early 2014. And then guess what? 2014? Well, that's an election year.
Mm-hmm.
So here we go again. This seems to be a problem that on some level is interminable. And there's nothing that is going to be done to address these problems. And certainly what we saw in Obama's first term, and this has impacted us as business people, because one of the things that's hurt business so badly is all of the uncertainty. Do we expect him to be any sort of a leader on this? Of course, you and I, if he does lead, we won't like the way he leads. So let's be clear. You know, Tom and I, our views about what government should do and the path we should take are different than Obama's. But that said, would we be happy with – will he lead at all?
Put it this way, will he lead – not to split hairs here. He will not lead in the way that I want him to. Policies aside, leading as far as laying out a vision, laying out some core principles, and then compromising around that. But I would expect him to stick to his core principles. That's what any leader should do. But I don't expect that. He will try to dictate – the entire package, or hand it off to the Senate, let the Senate try to do the dirty work, and he's not going to take a leadership role in trying to bring people together, in trying to have the conversations, in having to try to find first some common ground where people can actually agree, and then helping people make those compromises around the edges, but also allowing people to be able to stick to their core principles. If you don't allow two parties in a negotiation to stay with their core principles, there can't be a deal. There just can't be.
Right. Good old-fashioned Dick Morris-style triangulation. Poor
right.
Dick. Poor Dick Morris. I mean, here's a guy, you know, for those of you who might follow political commentary, and Dick Morris is always a guest on Fox News. He also has – we'll mention Dick Morris at AOL.com since he always loves to mention his own website.
Right. Maybe we could have him as a guest someday.
Maybe we could. We've actually met Dick a couple of times. He's a really nice guy. But he's been predicting a Romney landslide since, I think, 1988, 87, something like that, back when Reagan was president. And he was so far-sighted that he said in 2012 there would be a Romney landslide. And when I went to Starbucks this morning to get a cup of coffee, I half expected him to be behind the counter pouring it for me because I'm wondering if he's ever going to get work again. But, Dick, if you're out there, we still love you. But, boy, did you blow this one. So here's a question for you, Tom. I'm wondering, if you're a member of the U.S. House of Representatives and you're a Republican, how do you behave when the new session starts. Because if I'm one of those guys, I mean, I know how I would behave.
The new session in January.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know how I behave because I'm, you know, belligerent, nasty, and liked by few. But if you're a politician and you're a Republican in the U.S. House, and yeah, you just got reelected, but you lost a few guys, and Obama picked up a couple of Senate seats, and he won again, are these guys going to stand on what their principles are? Or do you think we might see a let them have what they want to have mentality, either because they say, let's let them do it and watch it fail, or because they say, we better not fight with them or we won't win election next time?
I think you're gonna have to look literally congressperson by congressperson, depending on their margins of victory back in their own districts. The more red that district is and the greater margin that they won by, the more they're going to hold to their principles and the more they're going to stand up as they did the last 2 years. The more narrow that margin, the closer they were to losing, I think they're going to feel a tremendous amount of pressure to do what their electorate, what their constituency, or to satisfy some of their constituency on the blue side. And they're going to be more likely to compromise. It's going to be fascinating to watch. But I think we haven't had the time, and I don't think we've ever done it, but go precinct by precinct and county by county and congressional district by congressional district to see how polarized or how what these margins were with the remaining Republicans. And I'm going to guess that it's pretty red. There aren't too many purple Republicans out there.
That could be, but if your theory is right, those purple Republicans, that's an interesting thing to call people, the Republicans of color, the purple-colored Republicans, they might be more likely to join House Democrats in votes,
yes,
meaning that the Senate will be able to do what Obama would like to have done. This could be, on some level, I can't think of the word I want to have. In his first 2 years in office, Obama had a majority in the House and the Senate. Then he lost it, and he truly lost it because the House was a belligerent opposition party for the last 2 years. But there could, on some level, be perhaps the House turns a shade itself.
Well, it remains to be seen. But I guess the point would be that they would feel more comfortable putting pressure on Boehner to be less, say, Tea Party-ish, less holding the line and more willing to compromise on principle with the White House and with the Senate. But we'll see. I really have no idea. But you'll see. I mean, when you look at the electoral map across the U.S. county by county, there's still an awful lot of red out there.
Right.
And I mean, we know people who, even though the electorate came out on the majority for Democrats, and they won bigger than expected on the Senate side. The Republicans who are back at home are still incredibly passionate, and I think have very high standards for their, especially congressional representatives, to stand firm.
Prediction: what happens on the tax, the extension of the Bush tax cuts?
You know, well, I honestly don't know, but there's one other variable in here, which we did not talk about, which I'd forgotten until just recently, which is the debt limit. The debt limit's going to expire before the end of the year.
That's
so
right.
Now, so you have that in addition to all of this. I think without presidential leadership, we could very easily go off this cliff. We could very easily not get the lower tax rates renewed and having this massive tax increase come January.
I think that my prediction is that the House will cave on the issue of raising taxes on higher income earners to be defined, however they define it, however they want to try to put an asterisk by it, however they want to try to mitigate it. They will cave on the high income earner tax issue, in large part because a big majority of American people want rich guys taxed more. Now, you know, and I know mathematically, it doesn't do anything to help. But cosmetically, it's something that I think they're going to think they can get away with and that it'll be okay with their constituents. And so I think that the tax cuts will then be extended for everybody over, except for those over some limit, and for them, something else will happen. Either the taxes will go back to the Clinton levels, or they'll go higher, or they'll go in stages. What the specific is, I won't predict, but I will predict that the Republican House caves on that particular tax issue. So let's talk about the economy now, you know, because it's a business show. We haven't forgotten that, but it is kind of fun. You know, I have to tell people who are good enough to listen to us, and we know most people do it by downloading the show after the fact. We don't have a bunch of live listeners. That's the convenience of internet radio. But for people who take the time to do it, you know, we feel a real privilege that we're sitting here the day after the election and we have a microphone and we have a chance to share our thoughts and perspectives. I think, you know, I'm 50 years old, and for 49 years I wanted to do this, and it took, you know, in year 50, here we go. So while we want to bring this back into our normal sort of business focus, which will be what we do most weeks, we did want to enjoy the opportunity to share some of our views and thoughts about the election, and hopefully do it in a responsible way as well. So we're giving you our opinion. Hopefully we're not offending anyone in the process. Reasonable people can differ. So let's talk about what's going to happen now in the economy. Mr. Kuchin, what are your thoughts?
It ain't good.
Yeah?
can
you be more specific, or do I want you to be more specific?
Well, I think in the short term, let's say short is up to 6 months out, you're going to see an increased level of uncertainty. And there's a type of uncertainty that businesses are used to managing, and that's market uncertainty. Market uncertainty is where companies compete. They compete over the uncertainty of what products are going to be available, what the consumer would like, what pricing is going to be. That's what business is all about. What we're facing is political uncertainty. We don't know what the rules of the game are. We don't know what the tax rates are. We don't know what the regulations are. We don't know what Washington, D.C. is going to tell you your human resource cost is, what benefits you have to offer them, and so on. That is creating – that companies can't compete at that level. Companies get frozen. So I think we're going to see unemployment popping up. We're going to see – well, depending on how they include temporary or part-time workers, we're going to see a decline in full-time work. We're going to see – I think a decline in business investment. We're going to see a decline in business spending on capital goods. And I think it's very likely that we're heading towards another recession either before the end of the year or early next year.
I agree with all of that. Wish I had something to say that was rosier, but let me make it worse. In addition to everything that you brought up, I've been on record for a while as saying that I think if Obama were elected to a second term, that we would see a tremendous outflow of financial resources from this country overseas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been sitting in a situation where for the last 3 years, large companies and banks, but let's just talk about non-banks because banks are different. They're just completely different. Large companies have been sitting.
But that's for another show.
But that's for another show. And we will get to banking. We promise you that. Companies have been sitting with large amounts of cash on their balance sheet, cash at historically high levels. And not only have they been sitting, well, let's say first they were sitting with liquidity. Now they're sitting with cash because the trend over the last 12 months has actually been to even get away from mutual funds and U.S. treasuries, mm-hmm. and really go straight to cash.
Right.
Now, if businesses have been sitting on all that liquidity, and we're going back 36 months when we were really seeing this, this goes back into 2010, it makes you believe, what were they waiting for? I mean, if they had the money then and they have the money now, it seems like they must be waiting for something. I suspect they were waiting for yesterday.
You bet.
And I think that now that we've had yesterday, they're going to make decisions about deploying their liquidity, and I think they'll deploy them elsewhere.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a well-known story, an anecdotal story out there after the end of the Second World War when Truman was president and when America was booming again. You know, a lot of people think that the war got us out of the Great Depression. That's nonsense. Just because we were building tanks and bombs and airplanes to be destroyed didn't mean we were growing economically. You know, anytime, you know, you can't buy tires for your car and you have to grow a victory garden, it doesn't mean there's economic prosperity. It was after the war that we recovered. And there was a conference held at a university out east, and I don't remember which one it was, but they brought in the leading industrialists in the United States. And they sat them in a big, giant symposium-style setting, and they had a conversation. And one of the things they asked this group was, you know, you're sort of the same group of people that were leading your companies during the 30s and through the 40s. You're booming today. You weren't booming then. You weren't investing dollars then. You are today. What's going on? What's the difference? The response from the group was, FDR didn't like us, and we knew he didn't like us. And we didn't know what he was going to do next. We were unwilling to commit resources in terms of capital. We didn't want to invest in projects or people when we didn't know what the rules of the game would be tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the environment we're sitting in today. Exactly the environment.
Right.
And there is no reason to think that this will be any different. You know, if you go back to the 1930s, which is when you have, that's where you have to go to find what we're in today. I mean, this is 1930 in high definition color and with a cell phone instead of a party line. But in other ways,
and black and white.
And black and white, right. Do you know that people actually were in black and white in the 1930s? My father told me that. If you go to 1937, the start of Roosevelt's second term, and look at what the numbers were like,
mm-hmm.
They were dreadful. They were awful. We had re-recessed. And I think you're right that we're going to have another one. I think it's coming.
Right.
I don't see any way around that.
Right. There's too much uncertainty, too. Because of the nature of the crisis that we've lived through over the last 4 years, companies have not just been doing well, and now they have to figure out what to do. They've done well, have not made investments. They went through a financial crisis where they were, if you remember back in late 08, there was a liquidity crisis, and companies were terrified that they were going to run out of cash. So for the last 4 years, they've been building up their cash reserves, one, to protect themselves from what happened in 08, but two, because they didn't know what to do, because they didn't know what the rules of the game are. Well, the rules of the game have became a little bit more clear last night. The investment opportunities for growth, for a higher return, is overseas. There are countries and markets that have a larger appetite for that investment, where companies can make a greater return to satisfy their shareholders, and it's not here.
Right. You know, the panel that I keep mentioning that I was on last week through Link Local, we had a couple of bankers on the panel. And one of the bankers, when I brought up this point where I made it clear that I felt that investment dollars would start to leave our country and go elsewhere, in good faith, and, you know, he made a point where he said, where would they go? You know, we're still the greatest nation on earth. And, of course, he's not here to defend himself, so I'm not going to pick too much on his comment. It's not fair. But at the time, I disagreed, and I disagree now, because is that really true? You know, we think of ourselves, just because we think of ourselves, as the greatest nation on earth and the place to be. But if you're a business right now and you're looking at hiring workers or investing in new plant or whatever it might be, is this really the best place to do it? Is this the best choice for you to make? Is this where you want the home of your new enterprise to be? I don't know that we can be quite so axiomatic about that anymore.
Right. I would absolutely agree with you. I've worked overseas. I spent a lot of time overseas. I lived and worked most recently about 8 years in Europe and in the Middle East. And what happens in globalization, which is nothing new, is capital, which is investment, is deployed, finds a place in the world where it is easiest to invest and you have the greatest chance of a good return, which means flexible labor markets, lower regulations, more competitive, where you're not competing for an interest in the government, but competing in the marketplace for consumers. We used to be that country. We used to be the place in the world that was the most dynamic, that if you made an investment and it turned out right, you could make a lot of money. You didn't have to share a whole bunch with the government through taxes. This was the place to be. We now have more strict labor laws. We have a higher cost of labor because of government regulation. We have more uncertainty because companies don't know what's going to happen to their investment when they make it in the U.S. This is not the place that's attracting capital right now. We are not the best market to make an investment in. That's very clear.
There is this one of the arguments that I find myself in quite often with people who might agree with you and I in terms of some of our political and economic views, but who look at the current circumstances differently, is that they say, well, all of these things are just cyclical, and it doesn't matter what's happening today because history tells us something different will happen tomorrow. And embedded in that statement and in that feeling are two notions that I think are false. Number one is that everything's cyclical. I think that's nonsense. All events have causes and effects. Now, when you step back and look at something on a sheet of graph paper over a long period of time, it may appear that you're looking at a cycle by the way it looks. But it doesn't mean that if different things had been done, that cycle couldn't have changed, or that graph wouldn't look differently, I should say. I don't think we're in something cyclical right now. I think we're in something that is a fundamental change in how this nation has decided to structure itself economically. The other thing is there's a feeling of American inevitability. Gosh, we've always been here. No, we haven't. We're going to last forever. Not necessarily. You know, the only countries in the world that haven't failed are the ones that are here at the moment. All the rest of them have come and gone, and that's most of human history. And I do think that there is a naivete on the part of a lot of Americans who think, well, it doesn't really matter how badly we screw this up. We can fix it tomorrow.
Right.
And by the way, we'll come out of this again because we always do.
Right.
I think that's folly.
Right. Right.
So from a business perspective, and, you know, in this world that we live in, the world our show lives in, of, you know, the privately held company,
right,
what should they be doing now? What do you think they're thinking?
Well, I think one of the challenges for we were just talking about the economy and say, large global companies or international companies. It's fairly easy for them to reallocate capital across borders. I mean, they send a wire transfer to a subsidiary in another part of the world, and the cash has gone out of the U.S. No big deal. Small companies don't have that ability.
Right.
If they don't have any foreign operations, to set one up, especially in this environment, looks incredibly complicated and incredibly difficult. So they simply don't have that option.
Right. And, you know, I think anecdotal stories are always a bit dangerous. You know, I guess anecdotal stories are dangerous if we look at the election, because most of the things we thought were from anecdotal stories.
Although the anecdotal stories on the other side were actually right.
Right. that's right. So at the risk of, and with the disclaimer that anecdotes are dangerous and can be misleading, let's share a couple from today. We're working with a client right now that has a company that they're trying to sell. And within just a few hours of the election the election results becoming final, two different companies who were interested in moving forward with that client essentially picked up the phone and said, based on what just happened in the election, we're not interested. Mm-hmm. And more to the point, they said, we're not interested in committing to any new projects right now, especially domestically in the United States.
Right.
Which, if there's some sort of ringing bell for what my prediction is, there's a small one. There's a small bell ringing about capital looking to maybe be deployed elsewhere.
Right. Well, you and I have known it's been very difficult for smaller businesses, privately owned businesses, to raise financing or raise new capital in the last 4 years.
Right.
It's been a little bit easier. There's been a little bit more stability in the last 2 years, let's say, year and a half. I think that changed last night. I think certainly until the sequestration and Tax-Mageddon issues are at least become a little bit more clear, that capital is just going to sit there. They are not going to be able to find new capital or new credit, new funding, new financing.
Right.
It's dried up.
A couple of other anecdotes that I've already heard today, given the fact that I was a little frustrated and disappointed by the election returns, I thought it was appropriate to do something to blow off some steam, and I elected to use the health club for that over lunchtime. So in the course of my workout today, which, by the way, seemed to be quite exhilarating, I think I did take out some frustration.
It didn't take too much today.
No, I didn't take too much today. I was motivated to lift weights. I was talking to a gentleman who is an attorney with a hedge fund, and this particular hedge fund has a pool of money sources, and they invest with stock exchange companies, small caps.
Mm-hmm.
So small businesses, but on the stock exchange. And, I asked, I said, so going into this election, you guys probably had meetings about what you thought this would look like for your business either way. You had to be prepared.
Right.
And he said, yeah, we did. And we knew that if the election went the way it went last night, that it was going to be something that would be adverse to business growth and it would impact us. He said, already today, just this morning, they've had two different phone calls from clients, one of whom has said, in essence, leave me out of the deals, the next deals that are coming up. I want to stay in cash. I don't want to take any risk. I don't want to invest in anything. And another client who's a business owner who said, almost in passing, but in talking about what he's doing with his company, he said, effective today, he will no longer be adding any full-time workers. All the workers he will add from this point forward will be part-time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that has to do with healthcare reform. And, and we haven't even talked about healthcare reform.
Right.
But it's hard. One of the things that happened when healthcare reform passed is that you and I thought, well, okay, the Supreme Court will take care of it. And then they didn't. And then when the Supreme Court didn't, we thought, well, okay, we've got the election in 2012, and that will take care of it. But it won't.
Mm-hmm.
So healthcare reform, already enacted, soon to be implemented, never to be understood, is on its way.
Right.
And the impact on the economy is going to be staggering.
Right.
Absolutely staggering.
Right. We are this is a big step forward, period, towards what the labor market looks like in Europe, which is the cost of hiring an employee becomes almost prohibitive. The cycle that an employer goes through to make that decision to hire someone, it ends up being such a commitment. And economically, oftentimes it doesn't make sense and they won't take the risk, so they don't hire. You end up with a permanent, and the economy is not growing fast enough to justify it, and the cost of the new employee is too high, so they just don't hire. You end up with low economic growth, higher normalized unemployment.
Right.
And underemployment.
Right. Yeah, I think we're going to run into a long-term adjustment process to what the rules are. And here's what's going to happen. Let me say it a different way. There's going to be an inordinate amount of time spent by businesses trying to figure out how to comply with and what to do about all these changes.
Right.
It is, I believe in a previous show, we talked about from a financing perspective, how businesses have had to devote so much time and so many resources into figuring out, what do I do to keep my bank happy? What do I do to make my balance sheet look like something my banker will like to see? What do I do to get my loan renewed? And all of these things are about presentation. They're about style over substance. And they are distractions from doing whatever in the hell it is that business person normally does.
Competing in the marketplace.
Right.
Right.
So in addition to the fact that businesses are more preoccupied with ever about how to fund their business, now they're going to be preoccupied with, what do I do about this healthcare issue?
Right.
And well, it's here.
I think most of our listeners probably know that you and I are in the consulting business, among other things.
And if
things.
They don't,
they should.
And when they know that, they should hire us.
Right. And they should go, if they're interested, they can look at our website, which is www.segwaysolutions.com. However, one of the things Brent and I have already started to do is take, and we would highly recommend it to any business, especially and including small to medium-sized privately owned companies, and that's basically to go through a strategic assessment. You have to look at how the world is today versus how it was yesterday, because it's fundamentally different. We have to re-examine your business plan and your strategy and be prepared for a low-growth environment where there are increasing regulations and restrictions on your doing business. There's going to be less market flexibility in whatever you do in labor markets, in your product markets. Expect stagnant consumer demand, even declining consumer demand. There's going to be continued tight credit, if not even more tightening of credit. There's also an increased importance in government relations. The government is becoming more and more and more important in your consumers' lives and in your business life, and you have to understand that and how it impacts it. And if you can, lobby, because we're already there, certainly for the big guys, in the in government relations helping your business. And lastly, inflation. When is the inflation monster going to hit?
It has to come. There's no way around the fact that the Federal Reserve can do what it's done with our money supply. And not ultimate. In fact, inflation is already here. You know, we kind of jumble terms, but inflation is an increase in the money supply. Higher prices are a symptom of inflation. So we always we call higher prices inflation. In fact, the inflation's already here. It hasn't manifested itself yet because all the cash has been hoarded.
Mm-hmm.
When the cash leaves the hoard, then we're going to see the inflation in the prices. By the way, I mean, America just voted yesterday, and nobody really talks about this. America just voted for $4.50 per gallon gas forever.
As a floor.
Right.
As a floor.
As a floor. And that's a pretty fascinating thing to do.
Right.
You know, there is nothing that will happen that will drive down energy prices. In what could happen? I mean, the laws of supply and demand, while not on the ballot last night, I know that we tried to repeal them. It didn't work. They're still here. This is why they call them laws. and so nothing is going to change from an energy perspective. And we're going to live with this permanent level of extremely high prices. You know, you and I are both fans of the Ayn Rand novel, Atlas Shrugged. By the way, folks, if you haven't read it, it's the greatest book you'll ever read. Whether you read it for the philosophy or the economics, or there's even some good love scenes, read it for whatever reason you want to read it. But a very good friend of mine once said to me, nobody can ever read that book and not have their life be changed afterwards one way or another. But, you know, in 1957, Ayn Rand wrote a novel about a world where business people had become completely at the mercy of the government, of bureaucrats, of rules, of regulation. And everything that was being driven and done in the marketplace had to be for the greater good, the public good. And one by one, those business people started to walk away, and Atlas shrugged. Where are we?
And success was demonized.
Success was demonized. Right, exactly. I mean, first of all, how prescient was she to write that book in 1957?
It was amazing in the last 4 years.
Right.
It's scary what's going to happen in the next 4 years.
You know, I went to see, they finally turned the novel into a movie. Perhaps not they're doing it in sequences. May not be the greatest films ever produced, but not too bad. At least they're trying. But in the second installment, which I saw at the theater last month, there's this scene where one of the protagonists from the novel stops at the gas station to fill up her SUV, and gas is $45 a gallon. And this is not something that actually was in the novel, but it's a liberty taken, little artistic license in updating the film. You know, and I looked at that in the movie, and it seemed outrageous and preposterous. Maybe $45 a gallon is preposterous. Maybe it isn't. We used to think $4.50 a gallon was preposterous.
Right.
So, you know, I suspect we're going to see a whole lot of folks, maybe not with the drama and the flair with which it happened in the novel, but I suspect we're going to see a lot of business people, especially the independent business person who has really held on as long as they can.
Right.
They perhaps have mortgaged their home. They've mortgaged their business assets. They've already done everything they can do to make their company successful. Those people might just be ready to shrug. You know, we know some of those people. People
right.
have said, I think maybe I've had enough.
Right.
And, you know, we've met them in real life. And it's, to me, it's fascinating and it's tragic to look in the eyes of someone who maybe has been in the same industry for 30-plus years. They built their company from scratch. And they're saying to you, not because they're worn out physically, but they're worn out mentally. I can't do this anymore.
Yep. That's where we are.
That is sort of where we are. So, but where we're going is, because we only have a couple minutes left, next week we will go back to normal. We will, instead of talking politics, although maybe we'll find a way to talk politics, we will have a guest on the show, Sue Cutler, and she's from Aging Info USA, and she will be talking about what is going on in America with workers and the senior people in their lives. I don't mean senior as in bosses, their moms, their dads, their grandparents, that they might be having to take care of, and the impact it has on their performance in the workplace. And this is pretty interesting because I've got a mother with Alzheimer's, and I know what effect this has on me. And by the way, read our blog.
Right.
Read our blog where we talk about this,
which you can find. You can always find.
Here we go. Here's the plug, folks. Go ahead, plug it.
You can always find this radio show, a link to it, and also the link to our latest blog on our website at www.segwaysolutions.com. You can always find the latest on there.
So anyway, Sue will talk about the impact it has on workers in the workforce and how employers really aren't doing enough to address this issue. It costs them time and money because of increased absenteeism and declining productivity. You know, we've got employee assistance programs now for virtually everything. I mean, I bet if you watch too much cable television on the weekend, you can probably call an 800 number and your employee assistance center will give you help. But on this issue of senior care, despite the aging of our population and what a problem it is, I think the market is lagging behind the problem just a little
bit. And this is a free market solution.
Wait, it's a non-free solution in the free market. There we go. Because otherwise we don't want to have poor Sue next week having people say that it's she doesn't charge. All right, we're out of time. I'm Brent Hamacek.
And I'm Tom Kuchin.
Thanks for listening. We enjoyed this today. Hope you did.